I use the term New Covenant when I talk about the theology that we promote here. You know that there are two primary approaches to looking at the Bible as a whole. There's what's called covenantalism. The opposite of that historically has been what's called dispensationalism. Covenantalism starts with the supposition that there is one overarching covenant that covers the whole Bible from Adam forward, and that God deals with people through several different ages under that one covenant. And they say that even though there's only one covenant, there are different administrations of that covenant, is the language that they use. And covenantalists are by and large amillennial. The other camp would be the group that says that there is a distinction between the Mosaic covenant and the new covenant of salvation by grace through faith. Therefore, there is such a clear distinction between the two of them that there can't be one overarching covenant for every historic group of people, that there is distinction between a couple of these covenants. And as we've been talking on Sunday morning, there is the Abrahamic covenant, which is the overarching covenant. We'll talk more about that on Sunday. But there is undeniably a distinction between the Mosaic covenant and the new covenant of salvation by grace through faith. So there were folk, I was one of them, John Riesinger kind of headed the movement, of people who said, you know, covenantalism isn't really satisfying, and that really dispensationalism isn't really satisfying in that I don't see seven distinct, clear, totally separated dispensations where God deals with different people groups in a completely unique way, which is what classic Darby-type, Scofield-type dispensationalism says. I often get lumped in with dispensationalists because I do see a distinction between the church and Israel. Covenantalism does not. They say that Israel is the church of the Old Testament and that the church is the new Israel or the true Israel or the spiritual Israel. So they kind of mix and match those terms so that they can say that Old Testament promises made to Israel that aren't fulfilled yet are fulfilled in the church in a spiritual sense, and then you can read Old Testament stories about Israel, and even Israel's law and even Israel's covenant is still imposed on the modern New Testament church, and the New Testament church is still bound by that law, that the law at Sinai is still binding on the conscience of the New Testament church. So we started using the term New Covenant, and last year, Fred Zaspel and Tom Wells, I think was his name, wrote a book on New Covenant theology, because people are trying to define in complete a form as covenantalism and dispensationalism have been now formulated. They're trying to formulate New Covenant theology in a way that it is a fully thought out and fully formed theology, a fully formed hermeneutic, a way to look at the Bible. And of course, the problem they're having is that guys like me leap in and say, yeah, I'm fully New Covenant because I'm okay with the fact that the New Covenant is made with Israel and Judah. That's what it says in Jeremiah 31, and that's exactly what it says in Hebrews 8. Before and after the cross, pre-cross, post-cross, you see both times that the New Covenant is made specifically with Israel and Judah. And so that's been the sticking point, the contention point now among even New Covenant guys, or that they're starting to say, well, you know, yeah, we're New Covenant, but some of them are trying to hold on to their amillennialism and saying, well, Jim's gone too far because he's all the way into dispensationalism. And so there's these different arguments. Now, I say all that to say, R.C. Sproul is such an amillennialist, and I'm naming him on purpose publicly, and I'll tell you why in a moment, but he is such an amillennialist that he calls himself a partial preterist. And we've talked about preterism before. Preterism is the notion that everything in the Old Testament that needs to be fulfilled was fulfilled as of 70 AD. And the only thing Sproul disagrees with the full preterists on is that he says Christ is still coming back. He doesn't believe that Christ came back in 70 AD. But he says everything else was fulfilled. And he wrote a book a couple years ago on that very subject, which he claimed was the death knell to dispensational thinking, which I thought was a tad egocentric. You know, I've written the book that completely annihilates this other theology. Well, no, not quite. And so he has a magazine called Table Talk. Anybody seen Table Talk?
I got a subscription.
Do you have Table Talk? Did you see the latest one that talks against New Covenant theology?
No, I didn't read that one because it's what it talked about.
It does. It talks against New Covenant theology.
I didn't. That's really, yep. I don't believe that one. So, and well, I really like it so much, I don't want to not like it.
Right. Well, believe it or not, it actually names John Riesinger and Fred Zaspel and Tom Wells by name. Calls them antinomian and goes this close to saying that they are heretics.
What's
antinomian? Oh,
thank you. Nomos is the Greek word for law. Antinomos, lawless. Antinomianism, lawlessness. So it's because of this. Like I said, covenantalists say that the law, you know, the law that was made with Israel at Mount Sinai. When God made the covenant at Mount Sinai, the only people there with him were Israel. And the only people he imposed that law on was Israel. There were people living in Africa at the time. There were Mongol hordes living over in Asia at the time. There were plenty of other people on the planet, and God did not make that covenant with them. He made the covenant with Israel. And the sign or the mark or the demarcation or the emblem of that particular covenant was keeping the Sabbath. And so New Covenant guys will say, well, there is a complete distinction between the old covenant law made specifically with Israel and the new covenant of salvation by grace through faith made with the church, which is made up of Jews and Gentiles. And Christ is not simply an interpreter of Moses. He is the new lawgiver who came and gave a unique and higher and better law than Moses did. And so covenantalists who say the law is still necessarily imposed on the church get mad at guys like us who just say what I just said, and the first epithet they throw at us is, you're antinomian. See, I was called this just last week, which is why it's all so interesting that it's coming up on the alt fan list. A guy chimed in who had been to our website and said, you're a new covenant guy, you're antinomian. And he threw around this language that made me go, where is this coming from? Yeah, then I saw Table Talk. And I used to write the Hebrews commentary that's on our website. I originally wrote for Sound of Grace, which is John Riesinger's magazine and website, soundofgrace.com. You can go there. This issue of Sound of Grace is dedicated just to his open letter answer to Sproul for making these comments. He said, you know, if you're going to go public in your magazine, I'm going to go public too and say. So, yeah, so there is now this argument on a national stage out there going on between New Covenant and covenantalists, both of whom are sovereign grace, both of whom would say they are reformed. So the point I'm making is when I bring up these things about covenantalism versus dispensationalism and I say I'm New Covenant, these are very, very important things because they really do define the entire hermeneutic, the entire approach that you bring to the Bible when you read it. Now, last week, I started reading out of Fred Zaspel's book to you, and as I was reading it, said, who's that sound like? And you guys all said, it sounds like you! And I said, yes, exactly. Fred and I think very much alike. And this month, in Table Talk publicly, he was called an antinomian, practically a heretic. And I'm right there with him, boy. I had a pastor tell me one time, a Sovereign Grace pastor, say, if you've never been accused of being antinomian, you're not preaching the gospel yet. And I think that's true. You have to understand that we Gentiles were not standing at the foot of Sinai when the law came down. God never handed us that covenant, nor did we ever agree to keep that covenant.
How can they pull that in? That Moses' law on Sinai still is against us? Is that, are they saying
they call it the third use of the law, and here's what it means.
First, let me get this straight. Are they saying that the law is what made us sinners and thus needed the grace?
What they would say is, no, you cannot be saved by the law.
Okay.
However, they would say that the law, and this is necessary, it's what's called a necessary consequence. Covenantalists will talk a lot about necessary consequence, which means if this theology is true, if our suppositions are true, they lead to necessary consequences. If it's true that Israel in the Old Testament is the church of the New Testament, then whatever covenants we are under, we were both under.
Oh, okay.
And that somehow even Israel in the wilderness, dying in the wilderness for 40 years, were under a covenant of grace because there were some who were saved by faith. So they go back to that. They say as long as it was anybody, Joshua, because Joshua and Caleb were saved by their willingness to go in and take the land by faith, that they, for having been saved by faith, that the covenant of salvation by grace through faith must have necessarily been available because we can find it available all the way back to Abraham. At the same time, then, they say that the law, which God at Mount Sinai
because
said was an everlasting law.
Faith in through the faith chapter in Hebrews where it says that by faith Abraham was saved. Abraham.
Right. And so if that's true, that Israel and the church are synonymous, then whatever covenant was made with one of them had to have been made with the other. It's a balancing act. So they have to find a way to apply the law to the New Testament church. And the way they do it is by what they call the third use of the law, which is that it isn't used to save you, but it is used as a means of sanctification. That even though God saved you by grace through faith, you then essentially march people back to Moses in order for them to live the sanctified holy life, in particular the Ten Commandments. They disassociate the Ten Commandments from the whole law because it would be real obvious to walk up and say, well, you know, you're not keeping the law either. You're wearing mixed fabrics, you know.
That, you ain't covering your head.
You're not covering your head.
I mean, you're wearing those big hats.
Exactly. So there's a lot of places where you're not wearing your prayer shawls and you're not keeping, you know, so they're very specific about the Ten Commandments. Now, this is where it gets trickier because they then say, well, the Ten Commandments are still the standard for the New Testament church, but 9 of the Ten Commandments are mentioned in the New Testament. For instance, the first commandment says, you'll have no other gods before me. When Jesus came along, he didn't abolish that and say, okay, idolatry. You know, I mean, he clearly continued to say, you'll have no other gods before Jehovah. He continually preached the supremacy of Father God. Building idols, you know, he clearly said, he went in and tore down everything in the temple. I mean, he was still for that. The third, shall not take God's name in vain. Absolutely. Jesus continued to uphold that. 5, murder, he continued to talk against murder. Committing adultery, he continued. Coveting, he continued. All those things continued. But the Sabbath, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Not only did Jesus not institute the Sabbath on his church, but Paul talked against it and said that the very life of faith is a Sabbathing, that we keep the Sabbath in our resting completely in Christ's finished work, and says that the Sabbath was a type of that very thing. And Jesus out and out broke the Sabbath and went so far as to tell the Pharisees men weren't made for the Sabbath was made for men. And it was a symbol of that covenant, is the point. So if you are new covenant in your thinking, when the new covenant was instituted and the old Sinai covenant ended, then the sign of that covenant also would have ended. The sign of that covenant being keep the Sabbath. Right? Does that make sense? And so the fourth commandment isn't mentioned anywhere. What covenantalists don't pay enough attention to is that Jesus did not just come along and interpret the law of Moses. He, in fact, changed the law of Moses. And that's the thing that they don't seem to be grasping enough. For instance, when Jesus said, you've heard it said, thou shalt not kill, they would have all said, okay, we're with that. You shall not kill. Okay, we get it. And he said, but I say to you, and as soon as he said that, but I say to you, he was placing himself either as the new lawgiver or as at least superior to Moses, because he said, Moses has said, now let me tell you this. And he said, but I say to you, if you hate your brother in your heart, you're guilty as a murderer. Now, it's easy to say, well, all that was an interpretation. What he was doing was saying that the Pharisees failed to understand the spiritual implications of what God meant back there on Sinai. And so now Jesus is opening up the full implication so that we have a fuller understanding of it. Okay, fair enough. Then Jesus comes around and says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, if your brother slaps you on the left cheek, give him your right cheek also. Now, that is not an interpretation. In fact, you can stare at eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth the rest of your life, and you will never figure out that the spiritual application of that is If somebody slaps you on the right cheek, give them your left cheek. Because it is not an interpretation, it is an entirely new law. It is a completely new concept. And in fact, it is a higher, better law because it is saying, instead of just justice, mercy. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, says you hurt me, I hurt you. Whereas if you hit me on your right, on the right cheek, I'll give you my left. That's a completely pacifistic, merciful, gracious view.
Hey, so according to covenantal, which I'm thinking I like, that I'm actually sanctified if I do an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth.
Well, what they would do then is they would say, and this is a trick that they play, they say that the law is broken down into three large categories. That it's broken down into a civil law, which is stuff like make sure that you build a ramp on the side of your house so if someone's working on your roof and they fall off, that they don't fall to their death because you built a ramp. That's in the law. Or if you're walking down the street and you see your neighbor's sheep, cattle, anything in a ditch, you were required by the law to stop and pull it out. So they say that those were civil laws. Then they say that there is ceremonial law, which was all the stuff about the priests and the Levites and the tabernacle and the sacrifices and the burning animals and the blood. They say that was ceremonial. And then they say that there is a moral law. And the moral law they define as the Ten Commandments. So they say that the civil aspects of it are good for learning basic sanctified life, how to be a good person. But they say that the ceremonial law is done away with in Christ because he is our new high priest. He replaced Aaron. But then they say that the moral law has never gone away. And I agree that the moral principles of the Ten Commandments, 9 of the 10 are restated in the New Testament. But not all 10 are. And nowhere, you can read the Old Testament from cover to cover, front to back, backwards and forwards, and upside down in several languages. And you will not find the law divided into 3 categories. It's the law. And the law works as a complete unit. And in fact, when Moses came down off Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments, he called those the tables of the covenant. Those phrases, tables of the covenant and Ten Commandments, are synonymous because the Ten Commandments were the tablets of that covenant that was made at that moment with those people. If Jesus hadn't restated 9 of the 10, then it would be easy for us to say, well, those don't apply anymore. They apply in the church and in the new covenant because Jesus restated them, but then he raised the bar on all of them. Yeah. So
horribly high.
Tremendously high. Tremendously high. Read the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
You know, can you do it?
No.
He put it way up high because that is ultimately what his kingdom's going to be like. That's how people are going to be in his kingdom. And it's far different than the Mosaic covenant because the Mosaic covenant was always external to people and it could only stand there and condemn you and say, you didn't do it again. There's another one you missed. That's the best it could do for you. Whereas the new covenant of salvation by grace through faith said, Christ working through you will give you the ability to do better, to work and press toward the mark, and forgive you in the places where you fell, which the law could never do. The law could never forgive you for what you did wrong. It could just condemn you for what you did wrong. Now, if you can't see the distinction between those two things, and if you can't see that Jesus didn't just interpret Moses, he changed Moses. He gave a new, separate, different, higher, better law than Moses. Well, that's distinction, which is why the terminology of the new covenant shows up in Jeremiah and Isaiah, and why the book of Hebrews says that it is now here and is instituted, and why Jesus at the Last Supper passed around the wine and said, take, drink, this is the New Testament in my blood. New, qualitatively new, brand new, not the old, the new. Paul would say that it... Yes, not the fulfillment of.
Actually, they would get rid of the ceremonial.
You have to, or else you have to keep cutting animals up.
Well, exactly, but I'm just saying, so that was very important to God, though. The ceremonial was the most important of the law.
But they were important for the purpose that they were the typology of the Christ to come.
Right.
And once the Christ came, Paul said, Book of Hebrews says, that those were merely shadows and that Christ was the substance that cast the shadow.
Yeah.
And that once the substance was here, there's no more need for the foreshadow. You now know what it's pointing you to. There it is.
Well, I see that, and they see that. But how can they hold on to the rest of them?
And you're making the argument, which is you end up, when you look at the necessary consequences of covenantalism, you end up asking the question, how can they, many, many times.
Right.
You say, well, how can they, well, how could they, well, what?
Well, I see where they did it and why.
Now, here's the point. If there are those points of contention or confusion in covenantalism where when you look at it, you can see, well, but the Bible says this, yes, but our necessary consequences say this. That's why the covenantalists, by the way, baptize children. That's why they're paedo-baptist across the board, is because they look at the old covenant that says circumcise your children, and so they go, oh, if we had to circumcise the children in the old covenant, the emblem in the new covenant would be baptize your children. And so they're making connections that the Bible doesn't make. Making leaps, right. Now, so people who hold to that very same theology that we all just agreed takes leaps are out there now saying that guys like Zaspel and Riesinger, and me by extension then, are heretical and antinomian because we're saying that that law made with Israel is done. It's gone. First, it wasn't made with us. It wasn't made with the church, and it wasn't made with Gentiles.
Well, did they say that about dispensationalists? Because they would clearly
absolutely.
Say
that. New covenant theology, they say, and dispensationalism basically go hand in hand, and both of them are not covenantalism, and therefore they are both anti-law, therefore they are both antinomian. And that if you are teaching anything other than historic covenantalism, which, by the way, long as we're this deep in, historically, the reformers of the 16th century, particularly John Calvin, but also Luther, coming out of the Catholic Church as they did, the Reformation, as I've said oftentimes, was about soteriology. How do people get saved? Are you saved by works or are you saved by grace through faith? That's what the argument was. They did not reform their eschatology, and they did not, as a consequence, reform their overarching hermeneutic. And the Catholic hermeneutic and eschatology at the time was amillennial covenantalism. So Calvin was a reformed theologian in his soteriology, but when you look at his total theology, he is covenantal amillennial. And so all these years later, people who want to say that they are consistent Calvinists are also amillennial covenantalists. And that's, you know, what they throw at me. That's the charge at me. You are not a consistently reformed, you know. You're not consistent with the Reformation. You're not fully reformed, whatever their language is that they type into me. You are not this, you are not that. And I say, right, I'm a biblicist. I'm a Paulinist. And that's why I like the language of New Covenant, is that that is the emphasis of everything I teach, that there is a new covenant of salvation by grace through faith, and thank God there is. If there wasn't, nobody gets saved. And so the emphasis is always there. Meanwhile, these guys are out there saying that we are antinomian. The implication of it is that what we teach is because you're saved by grace, it doesn't matter how you live. That you could live any old way, that's the charge.
Hyper-Calvinist.
When people say antinomian these days, especially if a covenantalist says it, what they're saying is, you are so against the law that you believe that people can live any old way and still be saved. And that's not anywhere near what we're saying. What we're saying is, it's not that we're without a law, we're just without the Sinai law, but we are under a new, higher, better law that has very distinct requirements to it to live a Christian life. We aren't out there saying, you're saved, live like hell. We're out there saying, you're bought with a price, now act like it. The price of Christ's blood was paid for you. You are now his representative on earth. People ought to see that in you. Jesus even said it, by this will all men know that you are mine, by your sacrificial love one for the other. Well, the law never required that, but Christ's law does. So we are not lawless. We, in fact, are following a higher, better law given by a higher, better lawgiver. And the same way that Christ replaced Aaron as our high priest, he also replaced Moses as our lawgiver because it is all wrapped up in him. So I said all that because I've been reading out of Fred Zaspel's book. So here we are. We're back to Fred Zaspel, the antinomian. We're on Ezekiel 38. And by the way, thank you to you all for coming out in this weather, because was convinced driving here that I'd be the only one here. So.
Ezekiel what?
Ezekiel 38. Reading from Fred's book here, this is his book, The Nations of Ezekiel 38 and 39, we are working on identifying a couple of these nations because it will help us in understanding this in the larger context. Under the heading Hermeneutical Guidelines in this booklet of Fred's, two principles of hermeneutics have direct bearing upon this study. First is the importance of literalism. Terms must be interpreted in their primary, ordinary, and usual meaning. The temptation is to apply them to something far removed from the author without explicit exegetical warrant, and so this must be carefully resisted. I agree completely. An examination of Ezekiel's terminology. Okay, now we get into the meat of the thing. The terms found in Ezekiel 38 that have to be considered are Gog, Magog, Rosh, Meshech, Tubal, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya, Gomer, and Togarma. Of these, several are easily identifiable. The more obvious nations will be treated first, and then we'll proceed to the more difficult. First off, Libya, Persia, and Ethiopia. Libya, oftentimes is called Put, P-U-T, in the Old Testament. And it remains today bearing that exact same name, lying just west of Egypt. So that's not too hard to find. There is also Persia. That's not hard to find. It also remains until the present day, except it's known as Iran. And of course, Iran has the largest air force in the Middle East today. Biblical Ethiopia, oftentimes called Cush, C-U-S-H, is not the Ethiopia we know today, but rather, historically, it's the land that is just south of Egypt, which today is known as the Northern Sudan. So you've got, think of Israel, think of where Israel is. Go south of Israel, you end up in northern Egypt. Just south of that is the historic area of Ethiopia. It's the Northern Sudan today. Now, by the way, yeah, those names should all sound familiar to you. Let's see. Iran, Libya, the Sudan, and Egypt. Those would be the very places we're sending all our ships and planes right now, because those are the nations south of and east of Jerusalem.
What was Iraq in?
Babylon. And what we now know as the city of Babylon is where the ancient kingdom of Babylon was. The next one that we have to work on is this place called Togarma. You know, I told you last week, in the Hebrew there are no vowels. In the Hebrew writing, it's just T-G-R-M, essentially, and has been pronounced Togarma for years. Togarma presents only a little more difficulty than the others. Togarma was a descendant of Noah through Japheth, and then through Gomer, according to Genesis 10, 1 through 3. He's known to Assyrian records as Tilgarimo, and the inserted L in his name was not uncommon and more than likely was silent. So it would have been Tigarimu, the city-state in eastern Anatolia or Asia Minor, which today is modern Turkey. So now Turkey, which is north of Israel, you're now looking at places that are east, south, and north of Israel. The only reason we're not finding ancient enemies west of them is that you're in the sea. More specifically, Ryrie states that it is the southeastern part of Turkey near the Syrian border. Oh, now wait a minute. Doesn't that sound familiar? Isn't that where all the fighting is going on? Between the Muslim Turks and the Syrians on the border there? The Kurds? That's the area. They all show up in Ezekiel 38 as having part in the big end time war. Why? Because these are all the nations that surround Israel. Todd and I were talking just earlier about that very thing, that of course as these are descendants of Esau, and as these are descendants of Ishmael, that they all started in the land of Canaan, and then as they became tribes and moved out, they moved north, east, and south of Jerusalem, but they didn't have to go far before they were in unoccupied areas and could essentially set up camps, create cities, build societies. And so, of course, the ancient descendants of the cast-off sons, Ishmael, Esau, of course they would set up camp all the way around Canaan. That's their homeland, is Canaan. And that's why those people groups who were the ancient enemies back then are still the ancient enemies today and still live in the same areas, because one of the things that the angel Gabriel told Ishmael's mother was that he would dwell among his brethren. They would always stay with themselves. And their hand would be against every man, and every man's hand would be against them. Now, by the way, none of that describes Europe. Nor do any of these ancient city names describe Europe. Nor are any of the ancient heritages taking you back to Europe. And in fact, if you follow European history, you'll find that there are far more lost tribes in Europe than there are ancient enemies in Europe. So it's not the European Union, is my point.
A couple weeks ago, you established that the empire was coming from the Middle East.
Yes, right. Which means, as Tiffany pointed out Sunday morning, because she was about 3 weeks ahead of me, thanks, Tiffany. Because Tiffany's brilliant and was just slightly ahead of me, she came up to me Sunday and she said, now wait a minute then. So then that means that the Antichrist is a descendant of Esau and Ishmael. And I said, right, now do you understand? Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated? Now you get it. Yeah. In the great scheme of things, the chosen people through whom the Christ would come and through whom all the nations of the earth would be blessed would go through the Jacob line, Jacob have I loved, who became the progenitor of the 12 tribes, who became the progenitor of Judah, through whom Jesus came. And then there's the Esau, the Edomites, the cast off, through whom the Antichrist is coming. And so, again, world history working its way down from God seeing two nations in the belly of one woman and saying, yeah, it's no wonder they're fighting. Of course they're fighting. And by the way, the one who had the birthright sold it off for a mess of pottage to his brother. So, yeah.
How do we know that Persia is Iran? And
well, Iran was called Persia up until, well, it was called Persia when I was a kid. When I was in school, it was still Persia.
All these other cities or lands, Gog yeah. and Magog, and this?
Most of it goes back to archaeology, digging up ancient cuneiform script, old tablets, finding the names that are on there. They name the kings, and then each time the king would name himself as being the king of an area. And so you could dig that stuff up. Like one of the arguments against the book of Daniel for a long time was that Daniel made reference to Belshazzar as being the son of Nabonidus. And for years there was no proof that Belshazzar ever was a king. They know that, you know, Nabonidus was a king in that area. But according to the book of Daniel, when the Medo-Persians came in, it was Belshazzar throwing this big feast, and there was no history anywhere, secular history, to say that Belshazzar ever was the king in Babylon. At the time, history and the chronicles of the kings say that Nabonidus was the king at the time. Then they dug up in the 1800s what's called the Nabonidus cylinder.
That was actually on the Discovery Channel.
Yeah, because it's cylindrical. And in it, Nabonidus is named as king and his son Belshazzar, which meant that for the several thousand years that there had been no secular evidence, people were saying, well, Daniel's wrong because there's no secular evidence. And they dug it up right there. Well, as soon as they did that, it gave credibility not only, again, to the line of kings according to what Daniel said, which was important to us as biblicists, but it also says that that was the lineage of kings here on this spot, in this nation, in this place. So when it names the name of the countries he ruled, that gives us some idea what those areas used to be called. So archaeology, and then also in Fred's case, he's also doing word etymology. How do names progress? Like Togarma, who Genesis tells us is a descendant of Noah, and then you follow where the Togarma tribe settled, and then you follow the archaeology backwards, and they meet in the area of Turkey. So it's kind of like when they were tracing the passage, I'm trying to think of the name of the author, who wrote a book 10 years ago called The Digs at Mount Nebo. It was called Joshua's Pillar Stones, The Digs at Mount Nebo. And what this guy did was, knowing that the Israelites were supposed to have traveled through the wilderness for 40 years and that they would have made clay pots coming out of Egypt, they would have had clay pottery that they used for just eating and drinking every day. And of course, when the pots broke, you would just leave them in the sand. You just leave them there. You wouldn't take them with you. So if you have several million people traveling around with utensils, then you ought to be able to follow the utensils. And that's what the guy did. He went to the River Jordan, where supposedly they crossed, and he found remnants of clay pottery that clearly said there was a massive people group right here on this side of the Jordan River, and it was not historically where people always assumed that crossing had taken place, because it was at the widest point in the river. Everybody thought it was probably a narrow point, because after all, it's a miracle. And the Bible even says it was at... Yeah, right, exactly. And the book of Joshua says that it was at flood stage when it happened, you know, so it was just really high. It was really something that they went across. But one of the things God had told them to do was when they got to the bed of the river, they were to pick up 12 stones and take those stones up to the side of the river and build an altar of these uncut stones and pile them up so that when future generations say, you read all this in Joshua, when your children come and say, what mean these stones, you will tell them, we went through the river right here. Your forefathers, your grandfathers went through right here because these stones are from the bed of this river, and there's no way we could have brought them out had the river not dried up long enough for us to come across it. Well, darn if this guy didn't find them. He went across right where the pottery was, and there were the stones.
Wow.
And so he wrote a book about it 10 years ago, and the amazing part was I heard an interview with him because I was so fascinated by the book at the time. And the interviewer said, what did this do for your faith? And he said, I'm not a theologian, I'm a historian, but it was pretty convincing, you know, another big piece of Old Testament history that no one had found because they didn't follow the pottery. So archaeology continues to uncover this stuff.
Do you remember the name of that book again?
It's called The Digs at Mount Nebo, N-E-B-O, Joshua's Pillar Stones, The Digs at Mount Nebo. Now, I told Libby to look for it just recently because I had 10 years ago seen it, and like so many of my books, I go, oh yeah, you want to borrow that? Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It's over when I was in Franklin. Oh yeah, hey, you want to borrow? Oh, that's fine. And then I never saw it again. So Libby's been looking for it, and she can't find it. If I can find it, I'll dig it out for you. The problem is a book like that gets published, and if nobody buys it, and it's such a limited interest book, then it's hard to find. So I've been looking on the internet for it. I wish I could come up with the author's name, but too many years. Well, so the answer to your question is, archaeology gives us, and word etymology gives us, the correlations between these nations. Okay, so we have now identified Tagarma as being Turkey near the Syrian border. Gomer has been mistakenly referred to as Germany. And you know, even this guy, who's this guy down in Texas who keeps writing these prophecy books? And he makes that mistake. He says Gomer is Germany because he's so sure it's the European Union. And so he just makes that leap. The problem is Gomer without vowels is GMR.
Germany.
And to get to Germany, you have to transpose those letters. You get GRM. That's a completely different word then. That's where etymology comes in. Do these words follow a natural course of succession in the language, or do you have to make a leap? It'd be like somebody saying that my name's Jim and Jennifer's name is Jen, and therefore we're the same person because it sounds close. Well, you can't do that with etymology. You can't say, well, we're going to take two letters and transpose them to make it work. You can't go GRM in a word that is anciently GMR. That's not the same word. That's a different word. So Gomer has been mistakenly referred to as Germany because of a supposed similarity of linguistic construction. This position has two serious errors. One of them is that the R and the M are reversed. Well, that would be pretty obvious. Ezekiel wrote of GMR, not GRM. The reversal is unwarranted linguistically. Furthermore, this similarity and inversion is based upon a comparison of Ezekiel's GMR with a modern English from Latin designation for Deutschland. Clearly, the similarity is only superficial. These two errors rule out absolutely any possibility that Gomer is Germany. However, GMR in the ancient Hebrew moving into the Arabic languages is well known to the ancient world as Gimarae, G-I-M-A-R-R-A-I, which is written out G-M-R in most of those Middle Eastern languages. And it is the North Central Asia Minor area that's known as Cappadocia in the New Testament. These people are also known as Kimmerians, K-M-R. Note that the change from the guttural G to the C is the simplest and most obvious interpretation. That happens in language where there is a Hebrew S with a mark over it that creates the sh sound as it moves through language. We add the SH to keep that sound, whereas K sounds and C sounds, the sound will stay the same, but the letters will change from language to language. So now we've got North Central Asia Minor. Have you noticed that these are all areas that surround Israel? These are all Middle Eastern nations. The identification of Rosh presents some difficulty, but some understand it to be a proper noun referring to Russia because it sounds like it.
Because it has an R.
It's got Rosh. Yeah, Russia.